So good morning, everybody, and welcome to our Star Strategy, Queensland Strategy Investor Day. Before we get into the substance, maybe just a couple of logistical things. Bathrooms are on the outside, right and right. If we have to evacuate, I'll have to ask you to go to the park that's in front of the hotel, the Victoria Park. I'm here today joined by my co-presenters this morning, Geoff Hogg and Greg Hawkins, as well as Patrick Tsang from Chow Tai Fook. And here in the room, we have a number of the Queensland-based management team, as well as Harry and Chad from Sydney. So if there's any curly questions, I'm sure we can answer them collectively. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll kick us off. I'll first start with a quick discussion of the group strategy and some sort of reminders of what we're trying to build. Then I'm going to hand over to Patrick to give us his perspective on, or give us a little bit more color on who Chow Tai Fook is and why we think we're a great partnership. After that, we'll take Q&As and then go outside for a little tour of the site. We'll go around Queen's Wharf. We can't go inside, and the only thing inside right now is a hole that's getting bigger and bigger. So we'll get to see more when we walk around the outside. After that, we get a presentation from Geoff on the details of the scope and the current planning for Queen's Wharf. Once that's done, we'll hop on the buses. They'll take us down to the Gold Coast, where we'll have lunch at the Garden, a quick property tour, and then more detail on the developments, the master plan, and what we're trying to build at the Gold Coast as well. We hope to conclude by 4:00 this afternoon. So, as I said, the focus today will be on Queensland, but we've got Greg Hawkins here from Sydney, so we'll do a little detour to just talk about the sovereign room while we've got everybody here. In terms of the presentation, let me get straight into the strategy. I'm on page number six of your presentation packs. And let me start with a brief reminder of who we are. We currently have three properties, as well as two other assets, the Sheraton Grand Mirage, which we own together with Chow Tai Fook and Far East, as well as the management right for the Gold Coast Convention Centre. The main point about our company is that we're transforming these casino hotels into large integrated resorts in each one of the locations we are. So here, Queen's Wharf, that's a project that we'll be looking at in a little while. At the Gold Coast, you'll get to see some of it's probably the most advanced of all of our properties in terms of giving you a sense of what we're trying to achieve. And then in Sydney, we have the Ritz-Carlton that's in planning and the Sovereign Room that's underway right now. What's not going to change is our focus. So with all of this investment that we're putting in, we're doing this because we're totally domestically focused, and what we're trying to do is build the best mousetrap, if you want, for domestic and international customers. So we have no intention to do anything outside the scope of this investment. If I can ask you to turn to page number eight, that gives you a little bit of a sense of the recent history. So we demerged from Tabcorp in June 2011, and in recent years, we've been able to demonstrate a reasonable expansion in our share price, and that's been supported by an expansion in our EPS and our DPS over the same period in time. Now, this earnings growth was really driven by above-system revenue growth. So on page number nine, you see that in the upper right-hand chart that we've had over the last 5 years, 10% aggregate growth in our domestic gaming business. In our international VIP business, despite the disruptions of last year, we've had 150% growth over the last 5 years since 2012. So strong, I think arguably very strong revenue growth in our business. And that's gone hand in hand with good expense management. So over that period of time where we've grown expenses by 6.8%, our operating costs have gone up by 2.8%. That means our operating costs as a percentage of revenue has declined, and that's the gray bar you've got on the chart, upper right-hand chart, the gray line that starts to snake down. So above-system revenue growth, good expense management, that leads to above-system EBITDA growth over the last 5 years. And The growth has really been happening in the locations where we've made the investment. On the left-hand side, you see what's been happening in Sydney since we completed the investment, the last big investment we undertook, which was the expansion of the main gaming floor and the construction of the Darling Hotel and the creation of private gaming rooms for our VIP guests. We've been able to increase earnings from about $215 million to north of $350 million worth of EBITDA year on year. So that's been generating very good returns. At the same time, in the Gold Coast, we've also seen a nice recovery in our earnings, where we're now north of $100 million, and that's really as a result of the upgrade that we put in through to the hotel rooms and the upgrade in the food and beverage. So it's the investment that's been driving the growth in our earnings. And, you know, that has allowed us to generate improving returns on capital. So the left-hand chart shows you return on tangible assets, and we take tangible assets because through the demerger we inherited a lot of goodwill, which obviously doesn't have to be amortized, so it just sits on the balance sheet. So this is return on tangible assets, which has increased over the last 5 years from 12.5% to 16%. And, you know, we are comfortable that the investments that we're making continue to generate the appropriate returns for us. So that's kind of just a little infomercial on the last 4 or 5 years of what we've achieved. And I just want you to remember that we've achieved above-system revenue growth and a good expense performance, which has led to good profitability for the investments that we've made so far. So where do we go from here? On page number 14, we outline the sort of the four key pillars or tenets of our strategy. First of all, we want to take advantage of the attractive market conditions and the favorable macro trends that exist in our core markets. Secondly, we want to maximize the value of the assets that we have, particularly the long-term licenses. We want to leverage our competitive capabilities, and we're doing that with our complementary partners. And I'm going to now just spend a little bit of time going through each one of those 4 points. The first point on the markets, all of you know this, but it's still worthwhile reflecting on it every now and then. So the Australian domestic gaming market is a $24 billion market. And in that market, over the last 5 years, casinos, as a group, have expanded their share from 15.6% of revenues to 22.7%. So casinos are gaining share in this market. And that's really because, you know, the competition is very fragmented. You're really talking about pubs and clubs. And because there are favorable regulatory settings. So if you look at the macro climate, the regulators are particularly concerned about the gambling that is happening in the communities, in the thousands of pubs and clubs that are around us. And that favors casinos, which tend to be better regulated, pay higher taxes, and do a lot more for the customer. The chart at the bottom, the bar chart on the right-hand side, shows you the long-term growth of the gaming industry, the gambling market in Australia. And there's just 2 points I want to highlight. One is it continues to grow. It continues to grow ahead of household disposable income. And it's a very steady, rock-steady growth. So at the top line, the only time we've ever had any, and even only marginal disruption, was during the GFC. You just see the little blips there between 2007 and 2009. At the bottom line, where you see the golden bars, which represent the casinos, you see the only time casino revenue didn't grow was in 2004-05, when smoking bans were introduced. Other than that, it's just been a rock-solid expansion of the industry. That's why we think it's a fantastic industry to be in. This market is further made attractive by tourism. And as you all know, inbound international tourism into Australia has been growing at double digits for the last 5 years. And by all accounts, that's not going to change. So the Tourism Australia forecast says over the next 10 years we'll have 9.3% compound growth, and most of the growth comes from Asian demographics. And that's favorable for us because there's a higher propensity to game out of these markets. This chart that you've got in front of you shows you the tourism expenditure by source market. And there's 2 key points out of that one. The first one is the gold line represents China. And China has overtaken all of the other source markets by a long stretch already by 2017. But by any measure, that will continue, and that will continue to expand quite dramatically. So that's why it's important, as we think about our capital investment, our long-term investment, that's the market that we're shooting for. That's the upside that we need to capture. There's one more macro trend that is probably worthwhile dwelling on just very briefly, and that's the domestic behavior of our local customers around going out, if you want. So if you look at the cafe and restaurant expenditure, that's been continuously outstripping, the growth of that has been outstripping household disposable income. And that's the reason for that is, and at this rate, we're still a long way behind most European countries and most Asian countries, in fact. And what's behind that is simply that people are moving back into the cities, they're moving into apartments, and rather than entertaining at home, they're entertaining by going out. So we think that's another important aspect for us because our larger integrated resorts are much more efficient ways to deliver a diversity of food and beverage. Now, in each one of these markets, as I said, and that's the second point I wanted to make, is we have long-term licenses. And so when I say long-term, I need to remind you that the first license that runs out for us is in 2093 in Sydney. The next one is 2121, and then the one in the Gold Coast is perpetual. So we have really long-dated opportunities. And in each one of those markets, we have attractive license conditions. No restrictions on tables, including electronic tables. So for a long, long time, we can continue to participate in the growth. And that goes hand in hand with the fact that our local markets continue to expand. So if you look at the population growth, both inbound immigration as well as Australian migration, Queensland and New South Wales are very attractive markets, and we set that out in the second chart there. And so what we're trying to do in each one of these markets, because they're attractive, we're trying to maximize our footprint and our exposure. And in this chart here, we just summarize what the target state, I'm on page number 19, we summarize what the target state looks like in 2025 in each one of the locations and the projects that are underway. So in Sydney, we hope to have 1,000 hotel rooms and expand the property to about 50 bars and restaurants, and we'll achieve that largely through the current upgrade of the Sovereign Room and the food and beverage that comes with that, as well as the Ritz-Carlton Tower. In the Gold Coast, we're looking at 1,400 hotel rooms. That's taking in the additional tower that we've agreed to build with our partners, and that's set out on the right-hand side. So there's one more tower to come that is now has been pre-sold and where we're now committing to build from August onwards. But there's potential to expand that even further. So we have DA for four additional towers on that side that would take the site up to 3,000 keys. And then in Queen's Wharf, that's going to be the focus for the discussion in a little while. In Queen's Wharf, we've now achieved a very positive planning outcome, which has allowed us to expand the scope of the project to $2.4 billion. To maximize the opportunity that we see both from the market, but also in terms of, as I said, the planning concessions that we've achieved. And building large resorts is interesting for us because they're much more efficient. This chart here is just a little bit of analysis that we did that highlights that in the Macau market, for example, the larger the resort, whether you measure it by GFA or hotel rooms, the larger the resort, the higher the EBITDA margin is. And that really has to do with the fact that we operate with a high fixed cost. So if you can amortize that over a larger base, you end up being more productive. And you end up being much more attractive because of the diversity of offering that you have. But we have more. But scale isn't the only basis for our competitive stance. I mentioned early on, our licenses are very good. I just want to highlight the fact that in terms of our gaming products, we do have competitive advantages over our over the pubs and clubs in terms of particularly jackpots, but also bet limits in particular. In terms of tables, we're unlimited. And MTGMs, we are in Queensland, we have retained exclusivity. And then we complement those gaming product concessions with our capabilities. Particularly, I want to highlight loyalty and increasingly customer service. And the evidence for that is best illustrated on that chart at the bottom right-hand side. Where we've made the investment and where we have competitive assets, you know, we are able to continuously to expand market share. So in Sydney, the slots market share has grown from, EGM market share has grown from 7.9% to 9.7% from 2011 to 2018. So that's a pretty impressive set of numbers, I think, if you think about the size of that market and the profitability of that market. I've previously talked about loyalty being important for us and being one of the key competitive weapons. Page 22 highlights why that is the case. So at the bottom of this funnel, you have our existing revenues from loyalty customers. It's about $1 billion. Based on the market research that we've undertaken and have now been able to validate, that only represents about a third of the gaming wallet of the customers that have signed up to the loyalty program. So the total gaming spend of the customers that we currently have in loyalty is actually $3 billion. And the market share of all the customers that we have in Sydney and in Queensland is about $11 billion. So that is saying, you know, we really have two priorities with our loyalty program. First of all, we need to get more from the existing customers, and we need to get more customers in our source markets onto loyalty so we can penetrate them. The third area of work that's underway for us in loyalty now is to make it more profitable. So over the last 18 months, we now have great data coming together that illustrates that some components are more valuable than others, and some components drive the right behavior, and others just cost us money. And so there's a lot of work underway right now to make that program more profitable within the existing construct. So these are just a couple of the key capabilities that we think are important for us to make these large resorts work. And we are pleased to be able to complement our own internal capabilities with those of our partners. And Patrick will talk more about Charter Fork's experience and capabilities, but I just want to say there's a lot more. There's obviously the development capability that we get with by working together with Charter Fork and Far East, but there's also the retail and distribution capability and the experience and the access to brands and customers from their hospitality ventures. And you may be aware that last month we strengthened the partnership that exists that we had in place for some of the new developments through a placement and a strategic alliance with Charter Fork and Far East. And that strategic alliance came in sort of two main components. One around specific development projects that we agreed to pursue together, but also a marketing alliance. And the marketing alliance is the one that we think is particularly interesting in the long run, because it ties together what we're trying to do with our partners with that big outbound tourism trend that we're observing. So as I've previously said, the future for inbound tourism is all out of Asia, in particular China. And you know, through Charter Fork's footprint in that market, we have the opportunity to access pre-qualified, high-value customers and put our non-gaming offering to these customers. So there's about 6 million, and Patrick will talk about, there's about 6 million customers on the Charter Fork customer database. If we are able to penetrate 1% of that market, that translates into about $30 million worth of EBITDA. So there's a lot of work underway right now from our end in collaboration with Charter Fork to say what are the segments and the different offerings that we're putting into the market. So there's different offerings for international VIPs and different offerings for premium mass customers. And we expect to see and get some traction on that next financial year. But the partnership doesn't just allow us to accelerate the growth in that tourism market. It also means that we can do more development quicker. And that's probably best illustrated through this chart here on page 26, where we look at the capital-efficient growth model that we're pursuing. So next tower that's coming up in the Gold Coast, our Tower 1, is a mixed-use tower that has a Dorset hotel at the bottom and about 400 apartments at the top. The total investment for that tower is about $400 million. Once that, which means that in terms of development funding, we probably have to put in about 40% of that. So $160 million of equity has to go in, and it will be a third, a third, a third, a third for us, and a third for our partners each. Once the tower is built, we then sell down the apartments, and the funding, the revenue from the apartments, funds the development cost. So if you translate that to our balance sheet, that means up front we put in $50 million worth of equity, and when the development is concluded, the sell down of the apartments repays the equity. And what we get for that, for a zero increase in our equity, is probably a doubling of our visitor nights at the Gold Coast. We expect that that tower will generate another 330,000 visitor nights on site, which should translate to about $20 million of additional flow through of EBITDA to the main gaming floor. So that's what we mean by the capital light model, and that's what we get out of doing a mixed use development with our partners. So that's our strategy. Let me now turn to the current trading and our priorities. Our priorities have not changed fundamentally, and they've evolved a little bit. So first of all, we continue to focus closely on the improving earnings across the group along the levers that we've previously addressed, mostly continuing to drive revenue with above system growth while maintaining our expense discipline. Secondly, we obviously have a fair bit of work on the way to develop, from a property development point of view, the plans in each one of the locations that we're at. And now the new priority for us is to demonstrate that we can commercialize the expanded joint venture effectively. In terms of our trading in the second half, we continued with a good top-line growth of 16.4% for the second half, with particularly good growth in Queensland in the VIP business. Our domestic gaming volume I would describe as solid. The revenue's been a little bit depressed at 2.6% growth because we've been unlucky. On a like-for-like basis, that 2.6% growth translates into 6.6% growth on constant win rates, table hold rates. So that's pretty pleasing because it says there's good volume momentum in the market. It also means that quite a few of our customers have a little bit of extra cash in their pockets, which we all know will normalize in the fullness of time. The international VIP business continues to do well. In the second half, we're up 63.7% in turnover terms, up on last year. The win rate is still a little bit below the 135, but better than we experienced in the first half. So we're happy with the momentum that we're experiencing in the business. In terms of the capital expenditure, I'm pleased to confirm that we're coming in at the lower end of the capital guidance previously of 450 to 480 for this year. As you can see on this chart here, this year is the peak capital year for us. From here on, our capital expenditure over the next 2 years will be more in the range of $300 to $350 million before then stepping down to $200 to $250 million. On top of this capital expenditure on this chart, there's equity injections for the Queen's Wharf project over the next 3 years up until 2021. And we're comfortable that we can fund all of this because we've got a strong balance sheet with 1.2 times net debt to actual EBITDA. So, we're able to fund this quite effectively. Now, the rest of the day will all be about Queensland, Queen's Wharf and the Gold Coast. But before we go there, I want to hand over to Greg Hawkins to just take us through the main project that we've got underway in Sydney, which is the Southern Room expansion. Greg?
Thanks, Matt, and good morning all. As Matt said, I've got a few slides here to take you through. It's probably going into a bit more detail as opposed to Matt's broader overview, but certainly worth spending some time on it to give you some insight into where we're heading with our development in Sydney. As you're probably aware, the Sovereign Room is our primary hub for premium local business across table games and electronic gaming. Also a destination for plenty of domestic business and some international as well. And similar to Mahogany and Teak in Crown Melbourne, the quality of that physical amenity, the service level the guests receive, and really the aspirational positioning of the room relevant to those customer tiers drives demand, loyalty and spend. So I'm certainly confident what we're designing will set a new benchmark in Australia. As you can see, our current sovereign room generates about a third of our local GGR in Sydney and has had a CAGR across 13 to 17 of 23.5%. So the success of that premium local focus, as well as the loyalty plan that Matt referred to over the last period, has really pushed the room to its limit. We're finding it we're at capacity during peak in the current sovereign room and have even experienced some members playing elsewhere across the property, really searching for a bit more comfort, which indicates we need to invest. So by nature of that, we saw a very clear need to create a new environment and experience for our premium local members. So we think that outstanding environment, excellent service and food and beverage amenity will absolutely lengthen the leisure and gambling time of those guests with us, which in turn will drive further revenue. Some of the other core drivers of the capital plan, so the current room has had minimal capital injected into it over recent years, and on most benchmarks is considered suboptimal. I'm sure some of you have seen the room. From a strategic defensive perspective, both domestically and obviously within the local changing competitive marketplace, the retention of these customers is absolutely fundamental for us. So Crown's core local acquisition target will clearly be this membership level. And as such, our investment in their loyalty and retention is critical. As we continue to grow ourselves via acquisition tactics from lower tiers, we know the number of platinum and diamond members will grow. So expanding that room is critical. And of course, we have a monopoly on EGMs in the premium tier. So it'll be a real yield focus for us as well. We're spending about $220 million on the room, and that'll extend it further east. It'll take in amazing water views and perspectives of the city. A few images there, as you can see. A new signature dining experience, bar with amazing views, indoor-outdoor gaming, as you would expect, private salon zones, and an exclusive chairman's diamond tier zone as well for those level of customers. From a timing perspective, the current room will close in August 2018, with the temporary facility also opening on the same day, and then the new Sovereign Resort opening mid-2020. So we'll move on to slide 31. So just a bit on the temporary Sovereign Room. So it's currently undergoing a fit-out. In late April, we relocated our silver membership tier from that room to make way for the fit-out. So the move of that silver membership has gone well, didn't result in any negative impact on GGR, and of course was executed with a strong comms plan, host management, amenity maintenance and tactical marketing offers. So the temporary sovereign room, as I mentioned, will operate from August 2018 to mid-2020. So we certainly recognise the critical need to relocate our diamond and platinum tier members cleanly and efficiently. So to that extent, we've strongly resourced the project team here, with the focus being on quality temporary facility design. So being very conscious of existing member behaviour, I've always found that's the fundamental. So appropriate quality in the temporary area, comfort, privacy, accessibility to the temporary facility, that's both by a valet and the car park, maintaining gaming unit numbers, including a new outdoor premium slot zone, adding a new temporary chairman's gaming location for diamond members, and of course a dining room and upscaled bar for that social activity which occurs in the room. Other areas of focus, process and operations, service enablement and improvement, and customer engagement and care. I was in Melbourne when we built the new Mahogany room there, so I certainly have a good sense of understanding of the depth of project planning required to ensure a seamless process. Also in our project team as a consultant is Scott Milburn, his ex-Crown in Macau, with a raft of depth in many opening and build projects in those locations as well. As mentioned, we have a very active engagement plan across the journey with our members, with a focus being on customer input into future plans enhancing customer recognition, and as you would expect, a detailed and structured comms plan. It did include researching their preference for relocating during the build, which was strongly preferred. We focused on what amenity they want in the room, with the logic of really wanting to build their equity into the future project as well. So we've got feedback on privacy, entry process, guest access, Wi-Fi, smoking areas, a whole raft of inputs which are very valuable to us. And we did that through ongoing direct research with those guests, from roadshows, lunches, a lot of one-on-one sessions, particularly with our top 300 or 400 members as well, and facilitated input sessions. So across the time frame, also upweight VIP events and tactical marketing activity, particularly during those critical cutover periods. Lots of hand-holding, as I mentioned. Looking at some improvement in hosting ratios for our top members, which is a critical one to make sure that behaviour of member from room to temporary to the permanent facility is managed very, very carefully. And further, and just as importantly, their embedded loyalty benefits and recognition will follow our premium members regardless of location. So we see this as a very positive initiative. So if members are playing in other locations within the property, other rooms, their service, recognition, food and beverage access level will follow them as well. So that's some insight into what we're doing in Sydney with the Sovereign Room. I'll leave it there. We'll probably have some questions later on and now hand back to Matt.
Well, I wonder whether if there's any questions specifically to Sovereign Room right now, we should bring cake while it's hot.
Oops. I can hear you. Sure.
As long as you can hear me. Can you just outline exactly what you did at the end of late April, the customer tiering, where they've gone, and then just how quickly, you know, and the potential disruption that you could foresee with the temporary facility and relocating those customers?
So where we are, so the existing Sovereign Room continues to trade currently. So we're currently fitting out the temporary facility. To enable that fit out, we had to relocate the Silver membership base that was in that facility. So we moved them to another location within the casino floor, just on the eastern side of the property, which, as I mentioned, went very, very well. So we haven't seen any impact on that Silver membership tier GGR performance pre and post that move. So the fit out of the temporary space is currently occurring. We expect that to open in August, when we'll transfer those Diamond Platinum members down into that space. Look, from my point of view, we've got to get the temporary amenity right, so the quality of it has to be appropriate in terms of what those members expect. So that's occurring, and that relates not just to maintaining a similar number of gaming units, which we're doing, but also food and beverage and bars which support that, the socialisation of the room. So to that extent, I think that detailed engagement of calling around 6,000 of our top members has been ongoing for about 8 months to date. Input into the future project, making sure they're getting some buy-in to what we're designing for them, and then taking them on that journey of current to temporary and then to future as well. So plenty of hand-holding, plenty of examples of what we're providing them, but particularly looking at the behavioural elements of those customers, how they get to the property, where they valet, where they go into the car park, how they're going to get into the new temporary room, which is all very similar to what they're currently doing. So we're trying to keep it, as you would expect, with minimal disruption. And I think our depth of project planning to date should stand us in good stead.
And sorry, just outdoor slots. Mm-hmm. That was an area of
attention.
Have you been able to maintain the number of outdoor slots?
Yeah, overall we will. But in addition to the temporary facility, we're also opening another outdoor singular slot destination for our premium members as well. And that'll maintain the overall number, but also keep that exclusivity available from a service and amenity point of view.
Question over there.
Hi, it's David from Macquarie. Just a question on private gaming in Sydney. I mean, obviously you guys are expanding the room significantly. What do you think about the potential market size of private gaming in Sydney, sort of once that's relaunched and sort of beyond?
Well, look, I think there's significant potential for it by nature of our investment, as you can see. That growth over the last 4 years has been significant. If you separate the two components of gaming there, there's a very, very deep slot machine market in New South Wales. We continue to look at how we can differentiate ourselves within that premium slot market as well. So the ability to grow that and acquire new customers across the network is significant. At the same time, we know that the penetration of table game play into Sydney is not as deep as Melbourne, so we see upside there as well as we progress. So we currently have around 6,000 members who access the room. We'd expect that number to grow significantly over the next 3 or 4 years as well.
Hi, Greg. It's Matt Ryan from UBS. Just interested in your comments around living through the Mahogany Room refurb a few years ago. Can you talk about how disruptive you thought that refurb was relative to what you're about to do in Sydney? And also, I think, looking back through the main floor performance of Melbourne, there doesn't appear to be a year where main floor revenue went negative. So just wondering if you could maybe think about that and how you think the next few years might play out while this Sovereign Room refurb's playing out.
Yeah, look, I think the key learnings from my perspective in Melbourne were just the depth of project management around that behavioural element. So really understanding your customers. If we talk about we having 6,000 members across Diamond and Platinum, to some extent there's an 80-20 there. So there's the top 500 or 600 customers are very, very valuable to us. So the depth of understanding those customers and how they're managed across that journey was certainly applicable in Melbourne, and we're carrying that through here. In Melbourne, there was a build adjacent to the existing gaming area, so there's probably more separation of play into offset areas, which we're trying to sort of lift and shift more specifically, which was a strong feedback demand from the existing members as well. I think as we progress forward, the build of the future Sovereign Room is very well separated from the main gaming floor activity. So there'll be certainly perimeter issues around the property, but from a gaming perspective, it should be as clean as possible. There's no doubt my continual focus is understanding who's managing the customers from a hosting perspective, how well we know them, how they currently get to the property, and making sure there's no impediment or significant change on that front. And most of them are either valeting or arriving specifically in parking, so access into temporary hasn't changed at all. So we want to make sure that, I don't know I'm reinforcing it, but that behavioural aspect of customers and the social aspect and who they play with in the room particularly is maintained as well.
You know, if I look at sort of the property over the last 4 or 5 years, and I comp it to Crown, which obviously you know quite well, it's always seemed to me like player segmentation at Crown versus Star, and I think it was partly to do with the property, but Crown always seemed more defined areas on the segmented part, and probably they had spent a lot more money, I've got to say, in those areas. So if I was to compare new Sovereign Room versus what exists in the country, is this going to address that player segmentation difference? So, you know, the fact that you don't have, you know, you haven't spent money at Sovereign Room for quite a while, right? So does that limit your ability to keep fostering sort of high-value players? And does that change in a new Sovereign Room type world?
Yeah, I think if you looked at what we've executed over the last 3 or 4 years, we've moved ahead dramatically in terms of that segmentation. So from a Silver Room Vantage to Gold Membership Oasis to Sovereign Room and Chairman's, we have 4 very well-defined physical amenities adjacent to the actual loyalty tiers that exist as well. Ours is in some ways a bit less overt than what you might know in Melbourne, but I certainly think the execution of that strategy over the last 4 years has resulted in significant growth. I think the Sovereign Room permanent that we're building will underline what we offer as a property in terms of making a very significant statement in the market and reassuring that our brand alignment with luxury, amenity, service and depth of loyalty is very much there. And a lot of the other capital plans around the property are sort of reinforcing the ongoing positioning of the property. And I look to the success of volume activity in international as well. So as we've changed our service focus, upgraded certainly some of our hotel areas and improved competence, we've seen a real push in volume. So I'm feeling very confident, and I think a lot of depth on that tiering we've executed well.
Sorry, yeah, a significant amount of CapEx. What are you actually getting for that? I mean, if you compare it to what you can get at building apartment hotel towers, it's, you know, almost commensurate with that these days.
Yeah, and I think I couldn't underline the significance of investing in this level of customer base in the Sydney and inbound domestic market as well. So we're pretty close to doubling the square meterage that's available, taking into account sort of all operating zones. You've got a significant upgrade in expanded food and beverage facility, which is very important, including premium dining rooms as well. You've got a general update in the number of gaming units across all segments there as well. You've got a very significant expansion of our premium chairman's area within the Sovereign Room footprint as well, which is critical. It's a very competitive space, that one as well. And then the socialisation aspect, which is very important to these rooms as well, is reflected by nature of what we're building. You know, I think one of the best social bar areas in a gaming space in Australia with amazing views. So I think that investment into the representation of GGR across the property is appropriate.
Larry Gandler, Credit Suisse. Operational question on the Sovereign Room. So I noticed that since April you've moved some members and maybe drawing a connection to the low hold rates across the casino. I'm just wondering if operationally hold rates have been affected, and going forward as you move, do you think hold rates could be affected, maybe less efficient?
Look, I don't think so. I think they're two separate matters. So moving silver members, less volatile by nature of the average bet at that tier. I think the volatility we've had has really been in the chairman's platinum end, so you can understand some of the significant customers we're entertaining in that tier by nature of the volatility they can expose to our business. So, look, I don't see any of that changing moving forward. That's just a normalisation we'd expect over a longer time period.
All right. I'm getting the finger from Harry. The broad finger. any more questions? Just take one more? No? Great.
Well, thank you.